reporting again after the lunch recess. We've decided on a course of action related to presentation of department's testimony. And we've determined in our discussions that department staff will attempt at least to present all of their narrative testimony today. And then copies of that narration will be provided to the parties, both in hard copy and over the website for document posting or documents. And the parties agree to that, and then we'll hold off on the examination or cross-examination of department witnesses until we convene on the 28th of May. I think all the parties agree to that. Okay. Mr. Vincent, you want to continue your testimony at this point?
Yes.
Thanks.
I'll resume my testimony with a new topic, faulting. HLI seems to take exception to our assertions that the PGSA might be faulted and that this faulting could serve as a partial or complete aquifer boundary. Specifically, HLI concludes in Exhibit 45 that, quote, with perhaps one exception, there is no evidence that the major faulting in the deep volcanic basement rocks, including that detected by the magnetometer survey conducted by M3 Eagle in 2007, offsets or even breaks the shallower water-bearing units, including the PGSA. The available evidence actually shows the opposite, that the deep-seated faults do not propagate to land surface or penetrate the younger sediments above. An exception is the mapped basin-bounding West Boise Eagle Fault extending into and apparently truncating the sedimentary section, end quote. They also wrote in Exhibit 45 that, quote, major faulting that formed the Western Snake Plain generally does not significantly cut or offset the younger sedimentary units shallower than 1,000 feet in the basin on the north side of the plain, end quote. They mentioned, quote, HLI did commission seismic reflection and magnetometer surveys mainly to determine deep structural features, end quote. Let me be clear on this point. Hydrology staff does not know whether there is fault gouge or fine-grained sediments infilling the fault plain, or whether there is offset of the PGSA across the fault that was mapped by Wood in his 2007 report, Exhibit 19B. We also don't know whether, and if so, how much any of those factors affect groundwater flow. We do know, however, that faults can and do exert control on groundwater in aquifers beneath the Western Snake Plain and elsewhere, acting as partial and, in some cases, more or less complete barriers to flow. That's why we're so interested in understanding the location and hydrologic functioning of faults in North Ada County, and why we've commissioned BSU's Center for Subsurface Geophysical Investigation to conduct a seismic study using a larger seismic source than was previously used. BSU's lead investigator would like to get started within the coming month. We are grateful to M3 for allowing us access to their property. The report for that study is not anticipated until next year, and the analysis would probably be conducted in the fall of this year, is the schedule. Another thing that we know about faults is that they don't typically occur in isolation. In the 1992 report, Exhibit 67, Squires, Wood, and Oshinsky used the term, quote, zone, end quote, to describe the faults that truncate and serve to limit the aerial extent of the Boise Aquifer system, which separates M3 from the Boise River recharge area. They stated, quote, the Boise Aquifer system is limited in aerial extent and depth. The sedimentary basin is bounded on the north by the crystalline rocks of the Idaho batholith, where sedimentary strata lap onto or faulted against these relatively impermeable granitic rocks. The cold water bearing section is further truncated along the basin bounding fault zone and other down to basin normal faults," end quote. The implication of the last sentence is that there are normal faults that are located away from the basin margin that also cut through the cold water sedimentary aquifers. We also know that HLI convinced their client that a study of the deep structural features was pertinent to this water right application, which involves pumping from an overlying sedimentary aquifer. The rationale for HLI commissioning a geophysical survey that, according to Dr. Wood, is not relevant to the PGSA groundwater study is unclear to staff. The rationale for submitting a non-relevant but site-specific study in support of their water right application also is unclear to staff. Moreover, a focus on deep structural features is not apparent in the report documenting the inconclusive seismic reflection survey that was commissioned by HLI. That report, Exhibit 13, included the following statement, quote, "The deep water table at the site means that the seismic signal must propagate through a significant thickness of unsaturated sediments prior to reaching the primary target, which in this case is the stratigraphy associated with the freshwater aquifer and the fault that appears to traverse the property," end quote. Also unclear to staff is why HLI now believes that the fault mapped by Wood using a magnetometer survey, quote, "does not act as a no-flow boundary as speculated by IDWR staff," end quote, when in their analysis of aquifer test data from the clean irrigation well test, they concluded, quote, "since the octosolve analyses used to generate a curve match required the use of a fault acting as a no-flow boundary, and because other subsurface geophysical mapping by HLI suggests a buried fault trace, it appears likely that such a fault may be present in the vicinity of the Kling well and that it may control groundwater movement in the aquifer to some extent," end quote. Here's a copy of a drawdown data plot from the Kling irrigation well test. It's figure 88 from exhibit 12. I want you to notice the notation that's been highlighted with a red circle. It says, quote, "best fit with no flow boundary 1,500 feet to the northeast from pumping well," end quote. And then below that it says, quote, "derivative analysis supports method, good fit throughout entire test period," end quote. I really don't see how it can be considered speculative on the part of staff to think that the fault that was identified by Wood in the panhandle of M3's property approximately 1,500 feet northeast of the Kling irrigation well acts as a no-flow boundary when it was HLI's own analyst that first proposed the idea in a submittal to the department. Before I go on, I want to point out something to the hearing officer. Staff does not appreciate being accused of being speculative or the implication that we are unaware of, quote, basic principles of hydrogeology, end quote, when all we have done is to review and try to make sense of the information that we have been provided by M3's consultant. That the fault mapped by Wood in his 2007 report might exert some level of control on groundwater flow in the PGSA is not an idea that we came up with on our own. HLI was compelled to identify the panhandle fault on four different well location maps in the report documenting the reanalysis of 16 aquifer tests. They also use the fault package in the computer-aided aquifer test analysis program, OctoSolve, in order to analyze test data from the clean irrigation well test. It was HLI, not the department, that pointed out, quote, geophysical evidence, Wood 2007, suggests that a structural fault may be present between TW4 and the monitored wells lying to the west, TW1, TW3, and clean irrigation well. Such a fault, if present, could have attenuated and or delayed the response in the portions of the Pierce Gulch sand aquifer lying to the west of the fault, caused by pumping the Pierce Gulch sand aquifer at a location east of the fault. In a manner similar to the SVR7 test, pumping from the clean irrigation well, located west of the possible fault, caused no measurable drawdowns in wells lying to the east of the fault, supporting the concept of a structural fault. End quote. Given this statement and the previously discussed aquifer test analysis, it's inconsistent for HLI to accuse the department of being speculative and to now assert that, quote, in short, there is no support for a suggestion that faulting offsets the PGSA, much less that it serves as a no-flow boundary, end quote. Dr. Wood's testimony that he doesn't believe that the magnetometer survey was relevant to the PGSA groundwater study seemingly is at odds with the fact that this work was commissioned by HLI and performed by Dr. Wood in the context of a study of PGSA groundwater. Let me give another example where conclusions by HLI are inconsistent with their analysis concerning negative, i.e. barrier or no-flow boundaries. The following statement appears in Exhibit 45, the response to our staff memorandum. Quote, negative hydraulic boundaries can be confirmed by pumping tests of properly constructed wells in the aquifer under investigation when they are evidenced by an increased rate of drawdown. Significant negative hydraulic boundaries did not show up in the 9-day SVR7 aquifer test or in the 30-day Lexington Hills test, both of which we consider to be of sufficient duration to have revealed boundaries. Indeed, as our previously submitted reports show, positive recharge boundaries were evident in those tests. End quote. I happen to disagree with that statement, but its meaning is pretty clear. According to HLI, there was no indication of negative, i.e. barrier or no-flow boundaries, during the SVR7 and Lexington Hills aquifer tests. Rather, there were indications of recharge boundaries in both tests. Now, I've already discussed the analysis of data from the SVR7 aquifer test, but I haven't yet talked about HLI's reanalysis of the Lexington Hills test. So here's what's written in Exhibit 12, the only submittal that discusses the Lexington Hills 30-day aquifer test. Quote, as noted in the hydrogeologic overview section of this report, the West Boise Eagle Fault lies approximately 1/2 mile to the northeast of the Lexington Hills well number 1. Review of well drillers' reports and the hydraulic data included in the CH2M Hill report indicate this fault acts as a no-flow barrier and edge to the Pierce Gulch sand aquifer. We incorporated the effects of this no-flow boundary into all the log-log type curve analyses. It's reasonable to assume that the understanding of the role of faults in the Boise Basin has evolved over the years. If so, however, I've not seen where changes in that understanding are explained in HLI's submittals. All we know for sure is that HLI's current stance is much more definitive than previously offered by M3's team of experts. Consider, for example, the following quote from the 1992 report that was authored by Squires, Wood, and Oshinsky, Exhibit 67. Quote, "In addition to the basin-bounding fault zone of the Boise Front, which truncates the lateral extent of aquifer units, other faults within the sedimentary section of the valley impede groundwater flow and limit the lateral extent of aquifer units. The extent to which these faults cut the sedimentary sequence above 1,000 feet is not presently known. The amount of movement offset that has occurred along these faults and the degree to which they affect groundwater movement is poorly understood at present." More recently, HLI offered Figure 2 in their response to our staff memorandum, Exhibit 45, as evidence that, quote, "major faulting that formed the western Snake Plain generally does not significantly cut or offset the younger sedimentary units, shallower than 1,000 feet, in the basin on the north side of the plain." Figure 2 shows in detail the nature of faults in the basin. End quote. Inspection of Figure 2 reveals that it can't be used directly to support that argument, since the beginning depth of the profile is greater than 1,000 feet. There simply are no data in the shallow section that includes the target aquifer. Indeed, the deep faults aren't shown as propagating to land surface on this figure, but based on the information in one cross section that doesn't extend into the shallow section, it's unclear whether the understanding of the hydrogeologic significance of shallow faults has improved since the 1992 report, which at that time described the level of understanding as poor.
Excuse me, Mr. Vincent, could you describe which cross-section to which you just referred?
It's Figure 2 from Exhibit 45.
Question. And if you're referring to this one, Mr. Vincent, then they're both Figure 2 and Figure 3 on the same page?
That's correct.
Okay,
Figures
so
2 and 3.
To both Figure 2 and 3? Just...
Yes, I didn't reference Figure 3, but it is also on on this slide.
Okay.
And it does have the same lack of data in the shallow section.
Okay.
As explained in our staff memorandum, the authors of Exhibit 33G, a 2002 report that was prepared for the Treasure Valley Hydrologic Project and offered as supporting documentation by M3, indicated that faulting along the basin margin adds complexity and uncertainty to the hydrogeologic setting. They stated, quote, "In addition to complexity inherent in deposition and erosion, a series of major faults bisect the stratigraphic section along the northern basin margin. The hydrologic impact of these faults is poorly understood, but they are likely to be an important influence on groundwater flow in the Boise area aquifers." End quote. As mentioned previously, the sustainability of the target aquifer at M3 is a function of whether there is strong hydraulic connection with the significant source of recharge. In this case, primary sources of recharge are thought to be distant from M3. As such, it should come as no surprise to M3's experts that we are concerned about faulting. Here then is how the fault issue looks from our perspective. 1. A basin margin fault was identified by HLI, which conceptually might limit hydraulic connection to the primary off-site recharge sources. Two, HLI then used the fault package of an aquifer test analysis software program to analyze the test data based on their understanding of the hydrogeologic setting and the goodness of fit of the test data to the theoretical response of a no-flow boundary. And then three, HLI dismissed the potential implications of faulting in their last submittal by saying, quote, "The influence of structural basin margin faulting, which is known to exist in the general vicinity, is not addressed here," end quote. The rationale for not addressing the fault issue is unclear to staff. I'd now like to touch on an issue which I think serves to distract us from the central issue, and that is the issue of groundwater flow direction. While I would agree that our ability to accurately predict hydrologic impacts is directly related to our knowledge of aquifer boundaries, and these ultimately impact flow direction, the magnitude of the actual impacts that would be caused by pumping are insensitive to whether groundwater flow is northwest from M3 toward the Payette River or west toward the Boise River. I agree with Mr. Faraday and Mr. Squires on that point. That's because the primary impact of pumping is water level decline, and in accordance with the principle of superposition, the distribution and amount of water level decline that occurs is independent of the flow direction. However, HLI implied otherwise in Exhibit 2 when they stated, quote, "The groundwater proposed to be withdrawn by M3 Eagle for its development will be from subsurface flow that has already departed the Boise Basin on its way to the Payette Basin, so that impacts to existing area water users in the lowlands near Eagle are predicted to be so small as to be insignificant," end quote. Though intuitively appealing, this assertion is contradicted by HLI's own modeling, which predicts water level declines of approximately 5 feet extending several miles in the upgradient direction for both versions of the M3 model. In other words, there is no reason to expect that the hydrologic impacts will be less significant if groundwater flow is to the Payette Basin. The more important issue in terms of long-term impacts is whether there is strong hydraulic communication between the PGSA beneath M3 and a significant source of recharge. HLI makes essentially the same argument as the basis for concluding in Exhibit 45 that, quote, "PGSA groundwater in the M3 Eagle vicinity is tributary in large part to the Payette River. We do not anticipate measurable impact to the Boise River in the reaches down gradient from the Eagle site," end quote. The bottom line is that drawdown in the alluvial aquifer along hydraulically connected reaches of the Boise River will reduce flow in the river. As stated in our staff memorandum, neither HLI nor the department has evaluated the impacts of pumping on senior surface water right holders. Before I finish, I would like to go on record that department staff does not particularly enjoy the role of adverse witness in having to get up here and defend ourselves. Staff is unanimous in believing that part of the reason that we are in this situation is because two of HLI's most important submittals were late, and their submittals and testimony have inconsistencies. Having said that, some contradictions are unavoidable, and admittedly, many of these are not significant in the context of M3's water right application. Others, however, are more critical, and an attempt should be made to resolve them. An apparent contradiction still needing resolution is how the PGSA could be so transmissive and strongly recharged by water from both superficial aquifers and leakage from the modern-day Boise River and New York Canal, as asserted by HLI and assumed in the M3 flow model, when, according to Mr. Glansman's testimony, the PGSA has no connection to shallow aquifers, and according to his geochemical analysis, the water beneath M3 is almost exclusively sourced from the, quote, geologically ancestral Boise River, end quote. The terminology that Mr. Glansman used to describe the source of PGSA water is geologically ancestral, not pre-modern. The geologic time scale extends back more than 4 billion years, so when a registered professional geologist like Mr. Glansman speaks using the terms geologically ancestral, he or she is talking about something that happened a very long time ago. Now, I heard Mr. Glansman testify that he understands geologically ancestral to apply to something that is more than 1,000 years old. Less than a minute later, however, he testified that he understands geologically ancestral to mean, quote, as much as 1,000 years old, end quote. Having listened to that testimony, I'm really not sure what geologically ancestral means to him. By his second definition, something more than 1,000 years old would be classified as older than geologically ancestral, which is a difficult concept to fathom, since 1,000 years isn't even a blip on the geologic time scale. Mr. Glansman also indicated that carbon age dating can't be used for water that's less than 5,000 years old, and that the only thing that he can say for sure about the age of PGSA groundwater is that it's somewhere between 0 and 5,000 years old. The problem with that is that he used carbon age dating as the basis for describing PGSA water as being sourced not from the Boise River, but from the geologically ancestral Boise River. He made that distinction. Staff did not. To further the confusion, HLI was compelled in their response to our staff memorandum to point out, quote, from this model, they estimated the PGSA groundwater from the Goddard No. 2 and HP wells to be about 2,960 years old. These sealed production wells are located about 1 mile south of the Boise River and have been pumped for at least a decade, so the estimated age should be accurate, end quote. Thus, despite Mr. Glansman's testimony, HLI feels that 2,960 years, an age that's intermediate between 0 and 5,000 years, is not only accurate, but should be reported in a document that was addressed to the hearing officer using three significant digits. While there remains a serious disconnect regarding the residence time issue, the similarity in major ion chemistry between UWID wells and M3 wells is support, though certainly not conclusive, for hydraulic connection to wells in the Boise Valley. Having said that, I'm not an expert on geochemistry. It's not just inconsistencies with complicated technical issues that we've struggled with in our review of M3's submittals. It's inconsistencies with seemingly straightforward concepts. It's difficult, for example, to reconcile HLI's statement in the aquifer test prospectus, quote, generally speaking, the longer the test, the better, end quote, with the statement in their response to our staff memorandum, quote, it is a common misconception that the longer the test, the better, end quote. One more set of observations before I close. I spent a fair amount of everyone's time this morning trying to address some of the major technical issues that were raised in HLI's response to the staff memorandum. It needs to be recognized, however, that there simply is not enough time to respond to all of HLI's criticisms. HLI accused staff of being incorrect on 6 different occasions, inaccurate on 3 occasions, speculative on 3 occasions, misleading on 3 occasions, and inappropriate on 2 occasions. Our analyses were described as being, quote, deeply flawed, end quote, and our rationale as having, quote, no scientific basis, end quote. HLI criticized staff for not discussing something from Dr. Ralston's affidavit, which is a document that we were not assigned to review. Staff also was criticized for not evaluating and discussing a series of cross-sections that are clearly labeled draft, which were given to us without a location map and which are not referenced by HLI in any of their own submittals, and which are devoid of both former geologic interpretation and stratigraphic correlation between boreholes. Despite these factors, HLI's opinion of the cross-sections on page 10 of Exhibit 45 is that, quote, all are significant to our analysis and support our conclusions about the nature of hydrogeology in the area and the lack of any PGSA truncating faults here other than the WBE fault, end quote. HLI accused staff of incorporating unintentional bias and significant errors and implied that we were cursory or incomplete in our review of their information on 3 occasions. We were criticized for not addressing uncertainty that's inherent in the use of data from wells that have unknown and are questionable well construction. Even though the aquifer test data provided by HLI as the basis for M3's application comes from 2 test wells that are, by their own estimation, partially penetrating, poorly documented, and poorly constructed. Moreover, I'm not aware that staff ever committed to performing a well construction uncertainty analysis of M3's data or that that should be our responsibility. I suggest that HLI might address the inconsistencies in their submittals rather than trying to pin additional responsibilities on staff. Review of M3's supporting materials is already a large responsibility. By my count, M3's submittals in support of this application include 9 different technical reports prepared by HLI, 3 geologic submittals containing a total of 19 separate geologic cross-sections, 11 composite diagrams, 9 maps, 1 master's thesis, 7 publications that were authored or co-authored by Dr. Spence Wood, 10 Treasure Valley Hydrologic Project reports, 22 miscellaneous data submittals, the rebuttal to our staff memorandum, and 8 different submittals dealing with the qualifications of M3's hydrogeologic experts. A frustration for me as a reviewer is that there are important aspects of the hydrogeologic conceptual model that are uniquely located in at least 5 different documents. The reanalysis of aquifer tests, Exhibit 12, the SVR 7 9-day aquifer test report, Exhibit 44, the geochemical characterization report, Exhibit 43, the groundwater flow modeling report, Exhibit 16, and the one-year progress report, Exhibit 2. Moreover, important information such as the fact that the Goddard No. 2 well produces 3,000-year-old PGSA groundwater was only recently introduced to us via the response to our staff memorandum. In closing, there are a lot of high-quality data that have been collected and analyzed on behalf of M3, and it seems to me, based upon some of the early testimony, that M3 is doing the right thing both in trying to minimize consumptive use of water and in helping to develop a better understanding of the hydrogeology in North Ada County. Frankly, however, our job as technical reviewers has been made difficult by the timing and the sheer volume of the submittals and by the numerous and difficult to resolve inconsistencies within them. Staff feels that there remain several unresolved issues that are germane to making a reasonably confident assessment of long-term hydrologic impacts, and we stand by our initial recommendation for a high rate long-term pumping test to help better evaluate aquifer boundary conditions in the vicinity of M3. We agree with Mr. Utting that the best way to predict long-term response to pumping, particularly in a complicated hydrogeologic setting such as that in North Ada County, is to measure it rather than to simulate it. That's all I have. I'm glad to stand for questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vincent. Based on our previous discussion, I think we'll defer your examination until the 28th of this month. Is that acceptable to all the parties again?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
And you'll provide written copies of what you have to do.
And yes.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. In the order of presentation of testimony, Mr. Owsley, are you next?
I am. Could I take 5 minutes?
Sure.